Good morning, members. We are going to call the meeting to order. We're going to start. We have three distinguished guests today, and I know they have lots of information for you, so we will try to divide the time exactly evenly and or less, because I know we have the state of the state today and everybody is anxious to get over here about what has to say to us about how he's going to cut our budget. With that, I would like to welcome to the committee Brandon Hathaway, who's a graduate student at the University of Minnesota, and Dr. Jane Hodson, who is his advisor, I understand. I heard Mr. Hathaway at a conference this fall and thought he had some interesting ideas that he could share with us as we are moving to a new future.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's an honor to be here today to tell you about the work that we're doing. As you said, my name is Brandon Hathaway, and I'm a PhD student at the University of Minnesota, and I work in the Department of Mechanical Engineering, where my advisor, Jane Davidson, and I, we study solar thermochemical cycles, so using solar energy to drive chemical processes. So I'm going to talk to you about today is a new project that I've been working on in my time there, which focuses on utilizing biomass energy as well as solar energy in a process known as the solar gasification of biomass. And being engineers, sometimes we like to put things into math speak a bit, so we refer to this as the renewable squared project. So to first give you kind of a vision of what we're intending to do with this process, what we'd like to do is to take and utilize feedstocks of biomass that are not utilized right now or that are hard to process, such as the cellulosic biomass, as you hear about, or algae, perhaps. We want to process these using a solar plant where you collect sunlight over an area using heliostat lumineers, like shown in the image there, and you focus them onto a solar reactor where that light energy is then used to drive this chemical process. Now, what you get for an output of this process is what's known as synthesis gas, which is a useful fuel gas. And that gas can be used on its own, or it can be easily converted into other common fuels, such as Fischer-Tropsch synthetic gasoline, or methanol, dimethyl ether, or even just hydrogen. So all of these fuels can then be used in standard applications, such as fuel cells, or you can use them in power plants for electricity, or in transportation fuels, such as what you find in your cars or trucks, as is today. So now, conventionally, this gasification process is carried out in what's known as a partial combustion sort of process. So you would take your biomass into a reactor, like what's shown in the figure here, and you burn part of it to get the heat energy out. And you use that heat to actually create your synthesis mix. Now, this partial combustion process actually burns part of your feedstock. So right away, you've used up about up to 40% of your energy right off the bat. So that's energy that's not able to be used in your later fuel. Now, when you have that partial combustion, that also means you produce a lot of carbon dioxide, and that will be present in your gas as well. And that's not useful, as we're all aware. And so that needs to be separated out. It requires an additional step. Now, when you have this combustion, you need to supply pure oxygen to the facility. So with the conventional method, this requires you have a dedicated oxygen plant, which can be quite expensive. You can make up to about half of the cost of these existing gasification processes. Some other problems that we run into are just the production of tars, or having ash as well producing your product stream, or forming sulfur compounds that can cause trouble in later processes. So all of these are issues that exist with the current process that we want to sort of avoid by using solar energy as an input rather than this part of combustion. So in our vision, what we would do is we would take our biomass, we process it with the amount of water, and we do this inside a solar receiver where concentrated sunlight supplies the heat rather than that combustion. And so our output would then be a synthesis gas that contains just carbon monoxide and hydrogen, not the carbon dioxide that we didn't want. Now these solar receivers, they're something that you would find either on a small scale, dish-style system like what's shown here, or it would be in a larger scale, a tower-style system where you have a field of mirrors that focus the light up to the central reactor where we then carry out this process. So now, to better compare our solar gasification process to conventional gasification, it's good to look at some numbers. So I'll show you how much energy we can get out from these processes. What you see in this plot is the amount of energy per unit mass of feedstock or biomass material that you're going to be using. Now, we'll start off with the regular cellulosic feedstock. In this case, we're looking at prairie grass, but these values will be representative of what you find for agricultural waste or other waste. Now, this feedstock starts off at about 17 megajoules of energy for every kilogram of feedstock that you work with. With the conventional gasification process, you take this material, and you add some water, but then you burn part of it using oxygen to generate the heat necessary for this process. And what you end up with then is your synthesis gas along with that carbon dioxide that we'd like to avoid. So when all said and done, the amount of energy you have available for your next step is about 10 megajoules of energy for every kilogram of feedstock. Now, on the other hand, with our solar process, we take this feedstock material and we combine it with water. And then instead of adding any oxygen, we simply add heat with direct concentrated solar energy. This allows us to produce our synthesis gas without the excessive carbon dioxide amount. And so, overall, what you have available for your next step is about 20.2 megajoules of energy for every kilogram of feedstock. Now, this is a significant improvement over the conventional gasification. And you'll notice it's actually more energy than what was initially available in that feedstock. So I'm going to break down how this is possible. Firstly, we've eliminated that partial combustion, so we haven't wasted any of our feedstock. So all of our original energy is available to be used in this later step. Now, that additional gain you see is from our upgrading of the original feedstock energy to higher energy fuel. And this is done with solar energy, so essentially, that is stored solar energy in the form of these fuels that can then be utilized at a later time whenever you need. Now, overall, this means that we're able to utilize our feedstock much more efficiently. Essentially, we're almost doubling the amount of output you can get per unit mass of feedstock process by using a fully renewable process using solar energy. So, if you want to look at it a little bit broader, we can compare this to what you find with other biofuels. If that synthesis gas would be used to produce liquid fuels that could be compared to these, is what I'll show you. What you see now is the net energy output for current biofuels, which means the amount of useful fuel you have available after you subtract off the amount of fuel that was used to plant the fuel or plant the biomass process or harvest them and process them. So this is per unit area as well. So this would be considering what you get out for a plot that's dedicated to these materials. So with our existing biofuels, such as corn ethanol, you get about 7.6 gigajoules of energy for every acre. And with soybean diesel, you get slightly less at 5.8 gigajoules of fuel for every acre of land that's plotted. These are both kind of comparable to each other. Now, in the next generation fuels, we want to start using these cellulosic biomass. And I'll show you now the net energy output for those. If you were to take a conventional gasification process using cellulosic biofuels and produce liquid transportation fuels with the Fischer-Tropsch process, you end up with about a little over 10 gigajoules of liquid fuel energy for every acre of land plotted. So that's already an improvement. Now, instead of using conventional gasification, you would use solar gasification and then convert that gas into a liquid fuel, you would have 20.9 gigajoules of energy available for every acre of land dedicated to these cellulosic biofuels. So right there you can see that's a doubling of what we can get with the existing gasification process and almost a tripling of what's available with the current biofuels that are on the market. This shows that there's definitely a lot of potential for the solar gasification process if we can get it off the ground. So, what we'll cover next now is the current state of solar gasification, where we are on the road to being able to use this process. So far, there have been some successes and some challenges unveiled with solar gasification process. Several researchers have tried different approaches with different reactions, and they've been able to show that you can use sunlight to drive this reaction, but they've ran into some problems. An example of one of the reactors is this one shown here, which I'll describe for you real quick. Now, in this reactor, it's known as a fluidized bed. So your biomass comes into this center column where focused solar energy then heats up that column with your fuel. You mix that with steam and you produce the synthesis gas like I described. Now, in this, as well as many other approaches, there have been some common problems that they all encountered. The first being there's problems with the heat transfer that goes on here, meaning the temperature inside that column where this reaction is going on can vary several hundred degrees in just a few centimeters inside there. And so that adds some difficulties in controlling this reaction. Additionally, there's problems where if the sunlight is interrupted, if, say, a cloud were to pass before your collectors, the temperature inside these reactors changes quite rapidly. So overall, they're very difficult to control. And when you can't have control of those temperatures, you run into problems such as incomplete reaction. Now, when your reaction doesn't go to completion, that means you're not processing all of your fuel, and you're producing intermediates such as tars that are not useful and actually cause problems in downstream processing. So these tars add to some of the contaminants that we mentioned before that can be present in the stream. So overall, these problems are preventing this from being commercialized as is. And so an approach that can circumnavigate these problems is what is definitely desired in order to move forward with this process. Fortunately, we have found an approach that's been suggested that holds a great amount of potential for being able to overcome these problems. And this approach involves using readily available, cheap, and environmentally benign salts in order to have this reaction carried out within it. So I want me to explain this a little bit. Say you have some reactor like I've shown here. You want to shine your concentrated solar energy on it to drive your reaction. What this approach entails is you fill this reactor with these salts. And at the temperatures at which this reaction takes place, these salts are in a liquid form. So now these liquid salts already have two properties that are very important for them. Firstly, they have a high thermal conductivity. So that means the temperature throughout these salts is very uniform, so all throughout the reaction have pretty well close to one temperature. The additional property is that they have a high heat capacity, and so that means if your sunlight were to be interrupted, like I mentioned, the cloud were to pass before the reflective system, with that interruption, the temperature still stays the same, and even after the sun goes down, we can maintain temperatures and keep this reaction going for a couple hours after sunset. So this means that we have a great thermal environment in which we can run our reaction. So inside this salt, then, we'd like to add our biomass and our steam. Then ideally, we would get our synthesis gas out, and we want to be able to pair this with existing chemical conversion processes. We want the synthesis gas to be clean. Luckily, this salt allows that, because it actually traps all those contaminants we mentioned that cause problems downstream. Any solid ash that is created, any sulfur compounds, or any tars remain inside this salt. Now, there's an additional bonus that just enhances the process overall, and that is the fact that these salts catalyze this process, or in other words, allow it to go more quickly. And additionally, any tars that are trapped inside the salt are actually converted into gas because of this catalysis process. And so your overall yield is almost 100%, so your conversion of biomass is nearly complete. So overall, this process allows us to overcome those problems, operate more quickly, and create a synthesis gas that's ready to be paired with downstream processes. As such, this is the approach that we've been working to research and are trying to understand better at this time. So, let me summarize it. In summary, we'd like you to walk away from this talk realizing, firstly, the advantages of this solar gas-based gasification process when you compare it to conventional gasification are strong and compelling. You get double the amount of yield you can produce from taking care of these cellulosic biomasses. You eliminate the need for having an associated oxygen plant, so it lowers the cost of your process, and you produce a clean fuel that's ready to be utilized right out of the system. Now, what our work is, currently we're working on demonstrating this molten salt process at the laboratory scale. So we're studying this reaction, and we're varying the parameters of the reaction so that we can understand its behavior very well for later design. But our upcoming research, we hope to We work with Jerry Hewen from the Applied Economics Department, and he will work to examine the economic feasibility of commercializing this process. So we'll consider what's involved in the harvest of these biomass materials and storage of them, as well as transporting them from a location where they can be produced into a solar facility where they can be turned into these useful fuels. We will also design and test prototype reactors that will be able to work with industry partners to actually test in on-sun conditions in real solar collecting facilities to verify that this reaction works well and to take steps towards commercialization. Now, before I finish, then, I want you to also keep in mind that this is just one project that we're working on. It's part of a much larger initiative in our research lab to create solar fuels with processes like this. And as part of this initiative, we are actually going to be constructing an indoor concentrated solar simulator. Now, this facility is really important to us because it allows us to expand the scope of our work to the point where we can characterize these high-temperature receivers and test these solar reactor and thermochemical reactor systems. And being able to do this here in-house will be a great advantage for us, as this facility allows us to simulate similar to the exact conditions that you would find in real concentrating solar facilities. so we can simulate steady conditions or transient conditions, and anything we'd really like for solar conditions, regardless of what the weather's like outdoors. As in Minnesota, you may know, not always amenable for solar radiation. So this facility will open the way for a lot more research for it, and it will also be the first of its kind in the United States. We hope this will be an important part in helping position Minnesota as a leader in renewable energy technology research. So having presented our work then, I'd like to be able to open up some questions or discussion you might have. Well, yield the remainder of our time to the chair.
I see questions. Well, I was going to give you one, but I think we'll start off with Representative Falsey.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. This is a wonderful presentation, Brandon, and you're much to be commended. And thank you for coming out on this cold morning to share it with us. I'm wondering if there's any, if you've identified any other waste that comes from this system and how to deal with it. I see that the tar and everything can be gasified. It's tar-free. Is there any other waste that we that we're looking at here, or that you've done some research on?
Good question, and I'd like to address that. Yes, as you mentioned, the tars that are a waste that sometimes are produced in conventional gasification, we take care of. But for this process, the main byproducts you get, there would be some sulfur compounds that are trapped inside the salt, as well as the ash that remains after this process. Fortunately, though, it's a simple design to simply take off a stream of this salt from the reactor and continuously clean it up. So you'll take out the ash compounds from the sulfur. And the sulfur, actually, in a lot of processes where you separate it out, becomes a commodity that is utilized by industrial sources. So that can actually be used, as well as the ash compounds as well. Once you refine them out of the salt, it's pretty much potassium and sodium that, again, are useful for industrial processes. So it won't be a waste per se, but just a commodity that needs to be put out for more useful purpose. But that's all that we'll be able to produce so far. So it seems like it's very managed.
Follow-up, Representative Stelzing. Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I were right now starting to construct or just getting ready to construct a new ethanol plant, for example, and I had access to a great deal of cellulosic material in my area, what would keep me from doing this process right now?
Right now, the only thing that keeps you from doing this process is the fact that the technology is still being developed. But once it comes into development, the fact that we're able to have such high yields for the amount of material we get means that this process will be able to take on biomass from many resources. And so it can help create the demand for biomass that we've been looking for, so that these agricultural wastes, as well as the low-input biomasses like grasses, can start having demand. And so it wouldn't necessarily compete against an ethanol facility, but it would allow the biomass to be utilized quite readily once the technology is available.
Can I add to that? Certainly.
If you just give your name for the record.
I'm Jane Davidson. I'm a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Minnesota. I live in Edina. I think that one of the important things to recognize is that the location of the solar plant is an important aspect. So while we may find that in Minnesota what the solar plants do is they provide a market for our biomass, it's not necessarily true that you would want to build the solar plant itself in our area. And we included in the handout at the back a map of the biomass resources and a map of the United States that indicates the solar resources. And so the dark areas on both of those maps are the ones that indicate where the highest potential is. And you can see that potentially some people feel that there might be a slight mismatch, but because most of the solar resources in the southwestern part of the United States, where most of the biomass resources in the midwestern part and, you know, down the middle of the United States. So while there may be some small technological reasons that you might want to solve some problems to move ahead, the real question is, where do you want to locate the plant? And I think that as we move forward and start to look at the economics, we'll be able to determine how far you can transport certain fuels and still be economically viable. And I think the key is that because we double the yield, you can reach out to a much broader area for processing. So I think that would be your major. There's really no technological reason not to build a solar plant. There are plenty all over the United States and in Europe. And so it's really a question of, do you want to locate it in the same place side by side with your ethanol plant?
So, quick follow-up, Madam Chair. So to be perfectly clear, then, there is no missing link in, there's no black box that has to be built yet or any technology piece that we don't have.
Madam Chair, Representative, I guess that I would say that there's no major unknown. But you have to recognize that all the biomass gasification that's taken place to date, it's been done in a laboratory. So going from the laboratory to a full-scale operation, there's a lot of engineering work to be done.
Thank you.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just to follow up on that, what you said, there's a lot of work to do to get something from the lab to commercialize. Do you have an idea of the time lag?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what we have discussed already with the company that produces these solar concentrator facilities is a timeline of roughly about a year before we hope to be able to be testing a pilot scale reactor at an actual on-sun system. So if that were to succeed and go well, then the technology would be there, and it'd simply be a matter of how long before people want to invest and actually commercialize it. Yeah. But hopefully within about a year, we plan on having that tested at pilot scale.
Okay, none of my question. The map that you have about solar radiation makes it look as though there are many places in Minnesota that have similar solar power resources as Florida. And I know when I talk to people about the potential of solar thermal and other forms of solar in Minnesota, they say, oh, well, you know, that not in Minnesota. It's too cold. We don't have resources, solar energy. And I just wanted to kind of get some feedback from you on the differences here between the red places and the green places. I don't know if I hear you saying that it's not cost effective to build this type of facility here, or it's not as cost effective. My understanding is we have plenty of solar energy to do things here, but I'm just wondering in terms of the return on investment, the
Madam
difference.
Madam Chair and representatives, that's a wonderful question. First of all, there are very different ways to use solar energy, and the resource that we have in the state of Minnesota is equivalent to, well, almost better than some of our neighboring states and is equivalent to areas of Florida. But if you look at this map, what you see is that that's still much lower than the southwestern region. And the type of solar resource that we have in the state of Minnesota is best used for lower temperature applications for buildings. So for space heating, for water heating, for even for cooling. When you start to use concentrated systems like the ones that Brandon is talking about, you can only use what's called beam radiation, which is pretty self-explanatory. You know, it's like the sunbeam. You can point and say it's coming from there. And so, first of all, the other types of systems are able to use what's called diffuse radiation, so that's even on a cloudy day you can get a solar resource. But when you're trying to use mirrors to move the sunlight around, you can only do it if you know where the sunlight comes from. So there you need to use beam radiation. And you need, because these plants are expensive, ideally they're better suited in the areas that are very dark on this map. So most people who've done the economics would say low temperature solar is applicable pretty much across the United States, definitely including Minnesota. High temperature solar thermal processes and plants are probably better located in the darker areas from an economic standpoint. You could place one in the state of Minnesota. It would actually operate reasonably well today because we have beautiful clear skies and good beam radiation, but we have short days. So that's really the twist to the story is, yes, it would work here, but it works much better elsewhere.
Just a follow-up. My concern is the idea of all this biomass being transported to the places where the sun is the brightest, because there's a tremendous amount of energy involved in collecting up the biomass and transporting it to that area.
I've got some nice analysis.
Thanks, Madam Chair, Representative. We've actually done an initial study on this to see what would be economically feasible. So we've compared what the cost of biomass is and then the output that you get if you were to process it through gasification at a facility located right here nearby where the biomass resources are. So what we want to look at when we do that analysis is the cost per unit energy, so what you can get out for how much it costs. Now with this process, again, you have to realize that we're able to pretty much double the amount of output we get. And so when we did the calculations, we found that a facility that's using the solar gasification process could achieve the same cost per unit of energy for its output after transporting biomass up to 1,000 miles away. So that means you could reach into Colorado, Utah, even the northern parts of Arizona, and still be able to reach all the way to the far end of southern Minnesota to gather biomass. So it's still economically competitive simply because of the fact that the yield is so enhanced by this process.
Last question, have you done a greenhouse gas emissions analysis on incorporating the transportation component?
When we did our analysis, we considered the energetic cost as well of moving the biomass. So that takes into account then inherently the amount of greenhouse production if we consider that all the transport is non-renewable. And typically what we get is about 1% of the total energy that we have available is consumed in the transportation. And so that means about 1% of our original feedstock is turned into non-renewable carbon dioxide. Now, comparatively, when you have the conventional gasification and you're just burning it up, there's actually about 30 to 40% of your material is going to be converted into carbon dioxide. So it's still a greatly decreased carbon footprint.
Thank you.
Two more questions here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you both for your work. In answering another question, you touched on my question, I believe, and it was in regard to the salt, and you said sodium, potassium, is that, are those the drivers in your salt there?
Yep, the salt we use would be sodium carbonate and potassium carbonate,
and
carbonate salt.
And a recyclable in that process you're talking about?
Yep. Mm-hmm. So what we plan to do is take off the seams of the salt and we clean out the contaminants, but the carbonate salt itself can be put right back into the reactor, so it can be a sort of closed loop system.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just following up on Representative Portman, you may not have to go to Arizona. It looks like there's a red area around Sturgis. You could bring it over to South Dakota. But my question was from the funding aspect. What your funding source, maybe I missed that at the beginning. Is this IRE funded, or where is this? Are there state dollars that go into your research?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am currently funding this work. I guess you could call this state funds, but I'm currently funding this work out of my own research resources at the University of Minnesota. We have applied for a IRE grant. As you may know, IRE is the University of Minnesota's Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment, and very generously funded by the state. We appreciate it very much. We have put together a relatively large proposal on thermochemical fuels that is considers three different approaches, this being one of them. And I'm very hopeful that that will be funded. I understand that those decisions will be made about March. And that will, we have also an industry partner who is committing a relatively large sum of cost sharing for that proposal. So we're hoping that it will move forward and we'll be able to prototype. But we'll do the basic studies with our current funding levels.
We have many. You're just generating wonderful questions. I have some. We're going to be very have to be very cautious now about how many more questions we take. But Representative Perkins.
Thank you, Chair. Just you compare your process to a conventional process. Are there any commercially sized conventional processes in use at this time?
Madam Chair, Representatives. Currently, there are several facilities that carry out gasification. but for the most part, they haven't been produced on large scale and coupled directly with chemical production facilities yet. So it's sort of in a pilot to small scale testing sort of stage, though the technology is there. And outside of the United States, in places such as Denmark, for example, they actually do use gasification a lot more, and they use it as part of their energy infrastructure for electricity generation and whatnot. So it's a lot less commercialized here, but it has the ability to be commercialized and used. So right now it's still being implemented bit by bit throughout the U.S.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Hathaway, thanks for your presentation. It was very, very nice. You talked about the solar radiation being the most predominant down in the southwestern part of the nation and the biomass up in the Midwest. You touched a little bit on the water that's needed. Could you share with us a little more on that? Would there be ample supplies of water in the southwestern part?
Sure. Yep. Thanks, Madam Chair, Representatives. The water is actually a very small amount that's used in this process. Typically, if you consider dry biomass, the amount of water you'd need to add to it to get the right balance would be about 10% of the weight of that material. But you have to keep in mind that a lot of these biomasses, when harvested, have between 15 to 20% moisture content already. So usually we consider dry biomass is what we would use because that's a little cheaper to ship since you get rid of that water weight. But all the same, if there's any difficulties with obtaining these amounts of water, which are still quite small, all you would have to do is simply take biomass that isn't fully dry and haul that in, and you're essentially bringing your moisture in with your material. And then you wouldn't need to add any additional water to create the essential fuels if you want.
I don't see other questions, and I wish we had some more time for you to tell us about some of the other things that are going on at the university in your unit, because obviously there are lots more going on, and I think we would love to hear about them. However, we can't do it at this time, but I really appreciate your giving us this snapshot of what you're doing, because it's exciting, because I know it's being replicated again and again in other projects. So thank you all for doing this. And members, one of the things I would just share with you, I was in the legislature when we started doing WIMS, and that wasn't just a little more than 10 years ago, and people said, oh, it's just much too unsophisticated. Now I look back at what we were putting up 10 years ago, it's clunky compared to what we have now. So this moves so fast with folks like you. So thank you for doing what you're doing.
Thank you very much. We enjoyed coming. Ask the staff. We'll tell you more.
Thanks so much. Next. Yes. Geraldo Ruiz, and this is going to be a little bit different because this is a new way or another way of looking at solar, but I thought it would be helpful because we are trying to look at, in this committee, some of the new things that we need to be preparing ourselves for, or preparing the state for. So with that, welcome to the committee, and we really appreciate your coming.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm very pleased to be here. I'm very moved, actually, to be serving this morning those who serve the people. I'm hoping to take a few moments to discuss with you a solar venture operating here in Minnesota now. And in doing so, we'd like to touch on the business model that we've chosen and why we believe that's something valuable to society. Chat a bit about the status of solar development in Minnesota, where we perceive the will of the people to be as we look at it as a business person or a business entity, what is the market interested in, and would like to propose to you solar as a engine for local economic development. And if you'll allow me, I'll also give you one man's perspective, one business person's perspective on how we can activate solar growth and local economic development. I was coached by Madam Chair just at the beginning to assume that there isn't necessarily a deep understanding of solar technologies, and I'd like to just take a moment to explain just a tad, and also maybe tie into the conversation we just had, there are a variety of solar technologies around in different stages of development and production. Some require higher concentrations of solar resource availability, and some require low. Today, available in a production mode are plenty of solar technologies, and plenty that have proven to be drivers of business, both in the United States and around the world. For ourselves, the choice we've made is to propose a model to residential and small businesses that really drives the picture here. An image of having solar photovoltaic panels deployed around society on rooftops and allowing for local generation. Okay? This is proposed as a service where there is a leasing agreement and a servicing agreement engaged between our company and each one of the customers over a 15-year period or so, and in that manner take away the upfront cost of these assets, generating assets. Okay? Now we have to keep in mind, if we look at the larger perspective of things, we're all accustomed to have electricity come through our outlets, and we give little thought to the fact that there is a power plant far away somewhere generating that electricity. And as we deploy new ways of generating electricity, such as solar, we are really competing against that paradigm, right? We no longer, those large plants oftentimes are fully depreciated, and operating costs are low, and therefore electricity is cheap in that manner of accounting for its cost, okay? And so when we deploy solar, we're looking at absorbing that initial capital expense and presenting it in a paradigm and a monthly fee that is acceptable to the average consumer. Make sense? As a company, we are fortunate enough to have key relationships with Xcel Energy, who selected us for a pilot project with a grant through the Renewable Development Fund, which you may likely be aware of, is a fund that is administered by Xcel and mandated by the state to give opportunity for project development of renewable sources in Minnesota and other areas in Minnesota, actually. We are engaged as of December 10th of 2008 in deploying 280 kilowatts of solar generation to approximately 50 sites in the Twin Cities. And we also have an equity investor, minority owner at this time, a large multinational, Bengoa Solar, who is headquartered in Spain. And you may have read news of its presence in the United States in developing a very large solar power plant in near Phoenix, and that's 280 megawatts. Now, to put things up just a tad in perspective, the Monticello nuclear power plant is rated at 572 megawatts, if my memory serves me right. So 280 megawatts is utility scale, and this will be by far the largest ever deployed in the United States, and it will be deployed in an area of high solar resource, okay? Because this will be a technology that's called concentrated solar. It requires such solar resource. We as a company work with solar photovoltaic technologies, and those are very, very viable at different levels of solar resource, okay? There is emerging growth in this particular model that we have pursued as of since December 7 of 2007, when Xcel selected us to receive the grant. We've seen just in the last 6 months, both in Connecticut and in California areas, other programs emerge. So there's definitely an interest elsewhere, a significant interest elsewhere to explore this. How do we bring solar to the people in a financially accessible way? Okay. if we look at where we are today in Minnesota, and look at numbers, the data is quite clear that there are other states that have moved very quickly towards deploying SOLE. As you can see, sadly, and I'm trying to make that point, we're not in that table. And there is an interesting phenomenon of legislative efforts that are leading in certain states that enable the growth of solar technology. So we have to recognize at this point that there is a tight connection between legislative will and the enabling of solar photovoltaic business. And I'll speak to that a bit more in a second. The irony is that when you look at solar resources, and this is a similar map to the one you saw before, we are doing well, and the southeastern, southwestern part of the United States is world-class level of solar resource. So the fact that we're somewhere in between Alaska, for example, and Arizona means that we have very fair resource and that we can do very well with solar. And so much so that I would like you to look at the solar resource available in Germany in comparison to ourselves. And clearly there is much less. It is comparable to what there is available in Alaska. And yet, Germany has been able to reach number one status worldwide in solar photovoltaic deployment. Okay? At the rate, not the total capacity installed, but the rate at which they're installing today is roughly of 500 megawatts on residential homes. So they're installing approximately a Monticello nuclear power plant every year in solar today. And on barns and in farms, there's also a sort of rural solar driven local economic development going on at the rate of 700 megawatts per year. And that's another power plant per year that they're building with solar. So please take that away and the understanding that we have the capability, at least from the sun's perspective, to do a similar economic development. There are a variety of studies out there that range between 7 to 13 installation jobs, full-time jobs that can be created per megawatt installed. Okay. And so you can do easily the numbers and start seeing the amount of job creation that can be tied into this too. There is much research and evidence based on economic development already has occurred elsewhere that will give you more precise data about this. This is well documented. I'm by no means an expert in that area, but I can tell you that I read that all the time as a business person that's trying to make solar development occur. Okay? So I invite you to do your own research in that regard. So if we take a very pragmatic look at what we have accomplished so far with our current energy legislation, renewable energy, we have a renewable portfolio standard, which is very progressive and has put in motion an extraordinary transformation. And we must recognize that in that regardless of the joy with which any of the utilities may have or may have not taken on the responsibilities given by new legislation to do renewable portfolio and have a standard to meet, there is definitely a faithful and loyal response from the utility industry to meet those standards. And there is no doubt that's a massive transformation. Xcel Energy just surpassed 1,000 megawatt of wind generation installed, and that's extraordinary. So once the will of the people, from my perspective, is expressed through legislation, We have a massive industry that can turn and move in that direction. We also must recognize, though, that utilities operate in certain paradigms of accounting for things cost-wise that don't necessarily recognize full environmental impact, healthcare costs, and such things. And there's also plenty of evidence of that around. I'm no expert, but an avid reader of information around that. And the latest study I saw from the University of California, Berkeley places somewhere around the 52 cents per kilowatt hour, the true cost, the full environmental cost of coal generated electricity. Regardless of how accurate that study is, it gives us a feel for really what we are bearing as a society in terms of cost. And that cost is not coming to us through our electric bill. It comes through, you know, we're all bearing it as consumers and constituents in other ways. So that's data. It's not good nor bad. It's simply the paradigm under which we work. And given that, as a preface to what I'm trying to explain here, the development of new renewable energy done by our utilities is largely focused on wind and can be met entirely without doing very little solar development. Okay? Xcel can meet 25% of its goal with wind. The rest of it they've already practically met already with the biomass they have and hydro that they also have. Minnesota Power, for example, their resource plan does not include any solar at this point. Grid River Energy is ahead of its RPS standard with negligible solar. So the other interesting fact of what has occurred so far is that community-based development has been underwhelming in a way. Many of us had high expectations of doing much more community-based wind development and solar, for that matter, but approximately only 20% of what's being developed is done in that matter. So we have to recognize that the economic impact locally of that, or the lack of impact that has. In other words, community-based development is going to leave many more dollars and create many more jobs locally than development done by large corporations, which are oftentimes taking that economic impact to other states. Okay? That's simply what's happening, not good nor bad, information that we have to recognize. And it's important to recognize it in the context of what choices shall we make if we wish to change that equation a bit and drive more local economic development, or not. That's the question before us. My perspective on the solar will of the people, as I call it, is that there is a lot of marketing research that has been done indicating that the average American in general is very interested in solar for their home and, interestingly, has an awareness of the negative environmental impact of conventional electricity. Percentages are very high. I've seen studies anywhere between 95% of the population. We did our own survey on our website, and the numbers for ourselves were 94%, as you can see there, which to me was astounding. In other words, that there is that much awareness around the environmental impact of conventional electricity. That's phenomenal. That to me says there's a grassroots movement, and once awareness occurs, that's the seed of change in my perspective. Also, 95% of the respondents are interested in solar, and interestingly, respondents are willing to pay 49% premium for solar power over their current electricity bill. Now, take that with a grain of salt. These folks are people that are interested in solar and probably pay with that percentage is reflective of that. But it's still indicative, okay? So remember when I said the full cost of conventional electricity spread through society beyond our electric bill, this to me says I, as an individual, am willing to recognize that and maybe pay a bit more for electricity if you can deliver to me clean electricity. Okay? The reason for the photographs there is that as a small startup company, we're getting undue attention in the media. It's not an egotistical thing, but my intent here is to portray to you that there is an interest among constituents and the general public in general, a great deal of interest in solar. So let's take a few moments to look at electricity generation in Minnesota today. Okay, the leftmost column is the total net generation expressed in megawatt hours per month, Department of Energy information. The next column is the coal percentage. In other words, that's the amount that we're generating with coal today. The next one is the column for renewable. The next one is solar. It is so small, it is insignificant. But I love it. I love it because there's only one way we can go from there. We also have to recognize we don't have any coal in Minnesota. We don't have any natural gas. And that means there is an economic impact to the choices we make for generating electricity in our state. Okay? Just to give you a feel for what that means in terms of dollars, this is Gerardo's calculation. This is not meant to be a strict scientific study, but if you assign the average retail electricity price, and average I mean residential, industrial, commercial, to the megawatt hours generated, you recognize that we're talking about billions of dollars every year that are part of the economic engine of our state. Okay? 2.4 of that, 2.4 billion per year is going to coal. All right? So then you ask yourself the question, if solar is viable to replace that coal, what would happen to our local economy if we chose as a people to give a direction to our industry, because we're talking about a regulated electricity industry, give them a new direction that says, do that. And that's because we're switching our economic focus to local money. And that column, as it shrinks and deploys into solar or renewable, stays in the economy. Okay? Again, the conversation is, well, if we can't do that, solar is expensive. Not really. I think we need to be compassionate when we hear the expression coal is the cheapest and solar is expensive, because folks that operate these infrastructures are following faithfully the dictates that they presently have, and they should account for coal in the manner they do and deliver it to us, because they are giving us reliable electricity at the lowest cost possible under the dictates they have. If we don't change the dictates, there is no reason why they shouldn't faithfully operate in service to society in the manner they do. Okay? So, let's remember, there is a long-term trend of droppage, the dropping of cost among solar infrastructure. It is only a matter of time when it will be par with coal, even as we choose to account for it now. The question is, what do we know from now until that time? Do we sit still and let that continue to drop elsewhere and create local development, economic development elsewhere? Or do we express a will to say, no, we will find a way to bridge this gap and make solar start happening now? Okay? It's the choice. The choice that I want to bring to your awareness. And we need to answer that question in the context, are the people in Minnesota understanding this or not? Okay? So, how do we activate solar local economic development? And with that, I will close. I must say that Free Energy is participating with a number of stakeholders under the Solar America Cities Initiative in a committee, a policy committee, where we're trying to put our minds together as to what position we'd like to take as a solar industry. And there is the City of Minneapolis, City of St. Paul, industry folks, Xcel Energy is combining, collaborating in this initiative too, and you'll probably be seeing the result of that position statement or a document. I as an organization, would put forth the best effort to try to collaborate in that. The result of that, I, as a single entity, I say is insufficient. We can do a lot more for the local economy a lot faster, but we have to recognize that consensus is also part of the game, and that's where you'll see that kind of statement differ from what I am about to tell you. As a business person, I say that in order to activate the industry, you have to give it a price signal. Price signal is the clearest manner in which you can finance these large capital-intensive types of projects. This type of price signal mechanism is one that has been proven to work. There are a number of different mechanisms out there. There's plenty of evidence and data suggesting that that will bring not only the desired results in development, but it is the lowest cost to society overall and improves fairness in that it allows for small-scale development, local economic development. Okay? There's a lot of terminology out there, feed-in tariffs, advanced renewable energy payments, all sorts of things. They're all come down to saying the kilowatt hour needs to be paid at this level for renewable energy, and that's a clear signal to a regulated industry. Yeah, the beauty of it is that we can adjust that over time. Remember, this is a massive undertaking. It'll take decades. So at any point in time as a society, we change that price signal and we allow for development to occur in the manner that we choose to. If we want different results, we must change the rules. This is one business person's perspective, and I am grateful for listening.
Well, thank you for that.
Are there any questions?
I think we only have a minute or two for questions because, but what I was fascinated when you said that there is so much rural use of solar in Germany. And rather than talking about it, if you have some information in writing or over email on that, if you could share that with the committee, I would make sure that we would get that around. I was struck by your map showing how much more solar we have than Germany and how much further ahead Germany is than we are. So if you had some information to share, I would make sure we get it around. With that, maybe we have time for one or two quick questions. Yes.
I'll be real quick. I just wanted to thank you, gentlemen, for his positive information on renewables. That's thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you for coming here today. I was just looking at the handout that we received, and I realize this isn't your handout, but I was hoping you could help me out anyway. I'm just looking at the size of the solar plants here that are in Barstow, California, and in Spain. What size of a solar power plant would you need to have comparable energy production to our current system?
What size of...
I'm looking at the picture right here. It's pictures of solar power plants. They're using solar panels. And I'm curious as to what size of a solar power plant would you need? What would the land space needed to be comparable to a traditional or conventional power plant that we have here today in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, I understand the question. I have not seen that before.
I apologize for putting you on the spot for somebody else's handout. But I
must say that is a technology that's either concentrated solar power or solar tower or both. We don't do that sort of solar technology. I'm not an expert in that matter. There is information readily available about land use for that larger deployment of utility-scale solar power plants, which is a little bit of a different proposition. Our company engages in small-scale development. We believe in this truly distributed generation and the economic value that it derives.
Madam Chair, I apologize. for being a little late here this morning, but hopefully we can get that kind of answer. I was just very curious about that.
I think the rooftops in your district and my district cover it. Mm-hmm. But I think we do have to move on, and we will. I'm glad to have this conversation because we are trying to prepare for the next generation. So thank you so much for coming. I appreciate it so much. I wish we have a few more time for questions because I do see them out there. We are going to welcome Dr. Richard Kiesling. And before, as he's setting up, members, there's some feedback on our audio system that I am hearing, and that means there's a cell phone on in here. So it may be my own. So I'm going to turn off my cell phone. It was on not ringing mode, but I do think that may be our problem here. Our systems are fairly sensitive. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for coming, and members, if we could direct our attention to Dr. Kiesling.
Good morning on this wonderful Minnesota morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Kiesling. I am a hydrologist and limnology specialist with the Minnesota Water Science Center of the U.S. Geological Survey. I'm here to talk about an issue that USGS and our cooperators have been working on for a number of years, giving you an update on what we know about emerging contaminants in Minnesota aquatic ecosystems, specifically where we are with our work on understanding and documenting endocrine active compounds and their effect primarily on fish. I'm going to give a brief overview of some of our information and then talk about a recent proposal that we put together to develop more detailed information about the effect of these compounds on fish. Most of the information we have started with collection in the 1990s, starting in 94, and then a more detailed collection of data in 97 and 98 as part of a national reconnaissance program that USGS had regarding environmental contaminants, trying to address three simple questions: where do they occur, or really do they occur, if they do at what levels, and are they present in mixtures? In other words, do we see them in groups? And this information's been published and is pretty well known, but I think it's worth reviewing to set the stage for our more detailed discussion of endocrine active compounds. This project involved developing analytical methods and then using these methods to look for the occurrence of 95 what we call other organic wastewater compounds in these broad categories that you see here. Probably of most interest to us in the discussion about endocrine active compounds are detergent degradation products, certain plasticizers, and hormones, and even some fragrances or musts, all of which can function as endocrine active compounds. This study was somewhat surprising in its time because it found a very high frequency of occurrence of these compounds in streams of different characteristics, that being downstream of wastewater treatment plants, but elsewhere. So they were broadly distributed. There were a large number of antibiotics found. Other drugs, both prescription and over-the-counter, were found. So they were in fairly wide distribution where they were sampled for. But they were in fairly low concentrations, as the second bullet makes. They were only a very few of them, 5% of the compounds, were detected above 1 part per billion. Another interesting point is many of these compounds were found in combination. As many as 38 of these compounds would be found in a single sample. And aggregated concentrations of some of these compounds can reach 80 parts per billion, a quarter of them were over 6 parts per billion, which is getting up into the range where they might exceed concern levels. This is just another way to look at the same data, looking at the top 10 of compounds that we found in these studies. I would draw your attention to those that are highlighted in yellow. That's the 4-nonylphenol, the nonylphenol ethoxylate of EO1, and the octaphenol ethoxylate EO1. These are known endocrine active compounds and have potential for endocrine disruption, and they made the basically the top 10 list of this preliminary study that was published in 2002. Another summary slide for this information shows that potential endocrine active compounds were very high in the detection frequency. Detergent metabolites, which is were one of the potential sources of the monophenols, alphaphenols, and plasticizers were high on the list. But even hormones and prescription drugs were had detection frequencies over 30%. So this kind of information led to the forming of a endocrine active compound research group, research partnerships, and the USGS was involved with a number of partners, focusing on the research interest of trying to document the occurrence, fate, and even understand the effects of EACs in Minnesota waters. And we have four general bulleted points here, focusing on trying to document the distribution of these compounds, then understanding their fate, that is, once they're in a stream, do they stay in the water, do they end up in the sediment, are they transported downstream, and how long does it take for them to degrade? So those are the kinds of questions that we were trying to, or are trying to address under number two. Causative factors, that being how do these compounds cause endocrine effects, and then what is the outcome of those effects, and then the extent of this disruption, which is brought on as a causative factor, in Minnesota fish populations. So, to try to answer those questions and to collect data on the distribution of these compounds, we've partnered with many, many state partners. They have sought us out, we have sought them out, and we've had very productive collaborations with many state organizations, state agencies. And they're listed here. Met Council, the Department of Health, DNR, PCAA, working very closely with Dr. Heiko Schoenfuss at St. Cloud State University and continue to collaborate with him. Colleagues at the University of Minnesota and our own internal colleagues in the Biological Research Division, and most importantly with the National Research Program, which funded the original national retrospective study. So, finally, some information about Minnesota. Here we see what our partnership process has involved in terms of sampling across the state. You'll notice there's been a great deal of focus on the Mississippi River. There's been two large studies done on the Mississippi, and there have been two fairly significant studies done on tributaries. One tributary study is focused primarily on the role of alkaphenols, and you'll see in a moment why that's been a focus. And that report has recently been released as a data series report, and I'll have a citation for that in a moment. But you can see that there are a fairly wide there's a fairly wide sampling pattern here, but over 95% of these sites are riverine sites. To date, USGS has only, before an ongoing project we have now, had only sampled one or two lakes in any significant way for the occurrence of these compounds. With that sampling, it's clear that there aren't a high number of compounds that are detected, but they are detected with high frequency at some of the sites you see here highlighted in yellow. They are generally characterized by a large number of endocrine active compounds associated with wastewater treatment plant effluents. In this study, we sampled 8 effluents, and the average number of EACs per effluent is 6. That's based on a fairly small sample size, considering there are over 500 wastewater treatment plants and facilities in Minnesota. But surface water downstream of wastewater treatment plants also show fairly significant numbers of these compounds. On average, we find 3 detections downstream of wastewater treatment plants. And then surface water, in general surface water, has a lower detection frequency and number. We only, on average, find 1 or slightly less than one of these EACs in a standard or in a conventional water quality sample. Well, the point I made about alkylphenols is shown here. It's a little difficult to see, but the reddish color in these bar charts that represent a characterization of forced wastewater treatment plant effluents shows that alkylphenols, which are a group of surfactants and which have a degradation path that can at times lead to nonylphenol and octaphenol that I talked about earlier, are a major component of these wastewater effluents. So we had focused in our most recent study, called the tributary study, on the fate and transport of these compounds in three smaller watersheds in Minnesota, smaller than the Mississippi River in any event. So instead of going through a detailed summary of what we have put forward in a number of our reports, what I wanted to do is tell you what we know today and how that leads into our current new project that we're trying to get off the ground. Basically, we know that endocrine disruption is present in Minnesota fish in rivers. Endocrine active compounds are present in wastewater treatment plant effluents and in surface waters downstream, but also upstream of wastewater treatment plants. That's a recent finding confirmed in our tributary study that although concentrations of these compounds tend to be higher downstream of wastewater treatment plants, they are found both upstream and downstream of the plants, and we know that there are non-point or other sources of these compounds other than just wastewater. The active compounds that are present elicit endocrine disruption in fish. That's been documented by taking effluent and running it through a culture, if you will, a culture device or a culture system that's housed in a trailer and looking at fish response as they're exposed to the effluent and seeing biomarkers or indication of endocrine disruption. And so we know that that happens. So we've tested the effect of the effluents on fish. But the interesting thing about it is that if you don't do those long-term exposures over a number of weeks, you run the risk of missing the signal because effluent chemistry and its effects vary over time, as you can imagine. This is similar to the issue that we've had in wastewaters with ambient toxicity. The effluent may be toxic for a while, but then a large majority of the time it may not. So the concentration of these compounds varies in the effluent, and its effects vary over time. And when you look at the fish in streams, the fish move around, and so they are not exposed to the effluent all the time unless you do it in an extreme level trailer, like we have done with our colleagues at St. Cloud State University. Alkylphenols are the likely contributors. This has been tested directly by exposing fish to alkylphenols. And different fish species respond differently, both in terms of their endocrine response, but also there are behavioral responses that vary by species. Life stage, or the growth stage of the fish, and whether it's in a larval form or an adult form, is also critical to understanding the response. And some work, at least that I'm aware of by Dr. Matt Julius at St. Cloud State University, suggests that food resources may also be affected. So there's a trophic component to these. There's a food web component to this issue. Currently, we're working on looking at the distribution of endocrine active compounds in lakes. We've done a small survey of passive samplers and sediment sampling. We've also deployed, as part of this study, fathead minnows in cages. That's work that's been done by Dr. Sean Foos at St. Cloud State University as part of this overall project that's in partnership with the PCA. And as part of this project, we've also looked at the fate of endocrine active compounds. We did what's called a Lagrangian study, which is following a water mass down a stream. We did this on the Redwood River near Marshall, and looking at the fate of compounds in that mass of water as it moves away from a potential source, and then also documenting fish responses during part of this study. And as I have at the bottom there, we have recently published the tributary study data report that was done by Kathy Lee and colleagues from St. Cloud State and the National Research Program. So what are we doing now, and what am I really here to talk about? Well, what I'm here to talk about and excited about is a new project that we've submitted for funding on assessing the vulnerability of lake fish species to endocrine disruption. We know that these compounds can accumulate in lake sediments and in marsh wetland sediments, and we know that there is a potential source of these compounds coming into lakes where there is a riverine input or where there is the potential for septic or on-site effluents to move off-site and move into lake waters. Why is it important to look at lakes? Well, recent work, somewhat earth-shattering work, really, by Karen Kidd up in the Inexplicable Lakes area in Ontario, in Canada, using manipulating lakes that are very similar to our northern Minnesota lakes, found that very low levels of endocrine disruptors in the 1 to 10 parts per trillion range, which is more than an order of magnitude lower than the parts per billion range I was talking about concentrations of some of these compounds, caused the complete multiple-year exposure, 2 or 3 year exposure, caused the complete reproductive failure and loss of fathead minnows from the lake. And fathead minnows are very important forage fish. So at the base of the predatory fish food web, if you will, we have this loss of a fathead minnow in an experimental treatment on a lake. Well, that suggests that we really need to be looking at lakes for concentrations of these compounds and potential impacts. Also, endocrine active compounds, as I said, are known to accumulate in sediments at 1 to 8 parts per billion, which is an order of magnitude higher than these documented environmentally effective concentrations in kids' study. And then on-site septic systems are also potential sources of emerging contaminants, according to recent studies. And we have many lakes in Minnesota that have significant on-site that have significant development around them with that rely on septic systems to handle their waste. So we proposed the study to look at juvenile and adult lake fish exposure, their response to exposure to EACs in a controlled environment using pond-scale enclosures known as mesocosms. If you can think about a mesocosm, it's bigger than a microcosm, smaller than a megacosm, it's a mesocosm. They identify how juvenile fish and common lake species will respond to these exposures, and they evaluate reproductive success of the exposed fish, both as juveniles that are exposed and let to mature to reproductive status and then let them reproduce and see if the juvenile exposures affects the reproduction, and then exposure as adults and looking at the adult exposure effect on reproduction. Mesocosms are great because you can control lots of variables that you can't control when you work out in the lake. Nobody can come along and steal your caged fish for bait. It's only happened once to us in our recent study. But the most important thing is you can control environmental factors, climate, geology, hydrology that might affect the results of your study. The flip side of that is that it's a somewhat artificial constraint, and you have to worry about container effects. That's why we try to pick a large enough size to minimize the container effects while still maintaining the control. Luckily, we have a mesocosm facility available to us as part of the USGS Biological Resource Division facility. It's the Upper Midwest Ecological Science Center, or Ecosystem Science Center. It's on the Mississippi River near Winona, right between Winona and La Crosse. And it has, as you can see in this picture, it has a series of outdoor ponds, and our protocol is to have enclosures or mesocosms suspended in those ponds so we can control what's going on with the chemicals, but we have the advantage of a larger mass of water to control temperature and other environmental factors. We also have a full culture facility here, and this facility rears the fish that we're going to be using. So we expose juveniles, and then we will rear them to adult size. The methods involve, as I said, juvenile exposure, working with free fish. We have fathead minnow, bluegill, and yellow perch. We also have walleye available to us, but we think we will have better luck working with the yellow perch. We'll use 3 known endocrine active compounds and measure the juvenile and adult response variables, especially looking at reproductive output and productive success. We'll also be tracking biomarkers from the fish that have been used in field studies to make sure our study maps onto the field study results. looking at the response of, you may have heard of the telogenin protein response in fish and male fish ending up with high levels of the telogenin, which is used for vision aids while fish form aids. So if males have high levels of the telogenin, it suggests something is going awry with the endocrine system. We'll also look at reproductive organs and look for evidence of abnormal development and the phenomenon known as intersex, which is the development of female reproductive tissue in male reproductive tissue, or vice versa, the failure of ovaries to develop, or the abnormalities in ovaries. And then we're going to be looking at behavioral responses as we mate the adult fish that were exposed as juveniles, which has been shown in the literature to be an endpoint biomarker. So the project, we hope, will tell us something more about the way lake fish might be affected by these compounds and at what concentrations these might be affected. It also will help us understand what's going on with water exposure and sediment-based exposure to these compounds, because we can manipulate those two things in the mesocosm. We hope that the results will be of use to resource managers to understand the risks posed to fish populations through EACs, so that we can forestall or forewarn them about the potential effects that were seen in Karen Pitt's study. And then also we hope that the results might be useful when statewide assessments are done under the Clean Water Act, if we're concerned about these compounds being part of the effluent stream. So that's a brief overview. I hope we still have time for questions. I'm more than happy to address them, and I've also listed some websites here where you can get more information about publications or more information about the National Toxic Study and about the Minnesota Water Science Center. I'd also be happy to provide the committee with any written materials they would like to see. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll defer to you for questions.
I do see some questions. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to request a copy of your presentation, if I could, please.
I'd be happy to provide that.
Representative Clark.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. You indicated that you're going to be using three endocrine disruptors. Are you using only three, or are you using three and different
in combination? No, we're only going to be using three, and we only plan to do single exposure. But
what are they?
That's still open in terms of the design. What we had planned to use was nonylphenol, and alkylphenol, an alkylphenol ethoxylate, which would be APE. And then we were going to be using a hormone. And it depends in part on which hormone we can get in a large enough supply. So we might actually use estradiol, or if we could, it would be great if we can get enough of the compound, use ethinyl estradiol, which is EE2. And the reason we might go with, the difference between those is how much estrogen activity those compounds have. And the more estrogen activity they have, they have higher potential effect.
Madam Chair, just one thing. I think probably most of us aren't chemists. We have a few on this committee, but understanding where these particular endocrine disruptors occur in various products might be very helpful for some of us who are sitting here. For example, I noticed you mentioned plasticizers, and I'm wondering which ones, because we know some things, and we have a discussion dealing with some of those products. So I'm just thinking, as you maybe answer some of our questions in the future, could we get, for example, where might we find APE, in a product that's putting it into our water stream and so on. So just wanted to mention that. It would be really helpful. Maybe you can just do a little translation for some of us.
Madam Chair and members, I'd be happy to provide that information. Our publications have a full list of those 95 compounds that I referred to in the national study. It talks about, and it lists the compounds, it lists where they get, what class of compounds they come from. Are they pharmaceuticals? Are they over-the-counter drugs? Are they detergent metabolites? And then potential sources. So I can provide that written material to the committee if that would be appropriate, or if that would need
to
happen.
We would be happy to get it around. I think we would do that.
Members, we've come to 10 o'clock, which is our bewitching hour. I really appreciate you coming, all of our folks that have helped us out as we look at what we need to plan for Minnesota's future. Just thank you so much. We have minutes. Representative Hansen, would you...
Move the minutes, approve the minutes.
Representative Hansen has moved approval of the minutes of January 15th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The minutes are approved. Members, we start with DNR on Monday, where we are going to look at their outcomes from the past budget. Have your questions ready? And with that, meeting... Oh, Tuesday, I'm sorry. Tuesday, beginning of the week, our first hearing on Tuesday. Thank you, and with that, meeting adjourned.